Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So when you have a sequence of volcanic eruptions, there's a whole series of changes that produces that get written about at the time. The sun is still in the sky, but you can't feel any warmth coming from it. Crops start to fail, and there's famine that starts to break out. And there are a whole bunch of different environmental pockets that harbour plague. And what becomes known as the Justinianic Plague sweeps through, probably killing something like 40% of the population.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet.
My conversation today is a great one. It raises a bunch of questions that feed into some of the journeys we've been taking here on Wild over the past few months around the climate crisis, around this idea of civilizational collapse, the history of previous collapses and patterns that can be observed, and whether there are opportunities for adaptation, for learning from previous cultures that did in fact survive climate calamities and collapses. My guest is Peter Frankopan. Peter is a professor of global history at Oxford University and professor of Silk Roads Studies at Cambridge University. But he's perhaps best known for his best-selling book, Silk Roads, which sold over 1 million copies and is Sunday Times' Book of the Decade. He's now written a very large book called The Earth Transformed, which frames many of the big moments in human history via a climate or weather pattern lens. This has previously rarely been done, in part because of the science. The tools, they just haven't existed until recently. There have been many different mega histories written over the past decade or so that posit why the Roman Empire fell, what saw the advent of the agricultural revolution. And the dominant theory here is the invention of the plough. But Peter shakes things up and points to, say, volcanoes that happened to erupt a year or so before large extinction-type plagues or a biblical flood and drought that precipitated the advent of gossip and melancholy epochs in art. Now, like many historians, Peter is keen to point out he's a historian, not a climate scientist or a collapsologist. He's also an academic who nobly doesn't talk in absolutes. He's observed that that's how history goes. It's complex and never absolute. But I press him at several times in our conversation to explain what we can learn about how and which societies did in fact adapt to climate calamities. What are the implications of the fact that our current climate calamity is both created by us and is global in reach? Our climate disaster is not a trigger event. It's kind of everything. And how does this affect the domino effect that history tends to take off the back of a climate disaster? Our conversation adds fascinating and helpful and perhaps hopeful or inspiring layers to the broader chat we've been having here and that I've been pursuing over on Substack. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Hey, Peter. Really lovely to have you join us here in Australia to talk about the themes in your doorstopper of a book, which I've been working my way through. I haven't finished it yet, I have to confess. But what I'm really interested in is the subtitle of the book, An Untold History. And I'm just wondering, why has this kind of climate calamity informed version of history not really being told before, and why are you telling it now?
Thanks, Sarah. That's a great question. Well, I guess there are lots of different answers. One is you need to have quite a snappy title for a book to distinguish it from the thousands of others on a bookshelf. So you've got to be telling people you're saying something new and not stuff they already know. That's one, I guess, starting point. The second is that there are lots of environmental historians who work on different parts of the world and different periods in the world. Sometimes it's quite important to join all those little jigsaw pieces into a big puzzle. And that's quite hard to do well. It requires lots of technical skills, a bit of languages, you know, ability to be brave. And so some of it is about trying to say, look, here's a big canvas where we could look at some of these big pictures too. So there are lots of my colleagues who work on different parts of the things I write on. And, you know, my footnotes are all online because it's already quite a big book anyway. And most people don't really care about footnotes. But if you do, they're all downloadable on a PDF. It's 250 pages just of notes. But, you know, those are all the people who are working in related fields to me. But, you know, you're right about why have we not really been interested in climate, the natural world, in the environment. I guess it's because when most people think about history, and certainly when they think about the history they learnt at their schools, it always tends to be about fat kings or brutal generals or great heroes. It tends to be about people. You know, you won't have heard a thing in a history lesson about geography or about geology or about a single other animal. History is all about humans. So I think trying to step back and do that also with history of not just joining up big periods and big jigsaws, but about saying, where do we sit within our own ecosystems? To remind ourselves, the most basic thing about human beings is that we're animals. And, you know, animals, their environments often change. And if you don't adapt, you go the same way of lots of other animals in the past, most famous for whom the dinosaurs, who aren't here anymore. So that's a second reason. And the other reason why it's an untold history, if you're really interested in your history, is that the ways in which we're changing how we look at the past, thanks to new sciences and new tools, means that the ways in which we can not just tell the story of the past, but understand it, are hugely enhanced by being able to rely on plant sciences, earth sciences, genetics, and so on, to be able to measure things in ways that we wouldn't have been able to do 20 or 30 years ago. So for all those three big reasons, it's untold.
Yeah, and I imagine also the fact that we're having a bit of a reckoning somewhat in and around climate, and the fact that we are of our environment, we are of a habitat, which is something I think we've been in denial about for several hundred years. It's kind of causing us to look at things quite differently, which is why I find your book really interesting and exciting. Why don't we start with an example that can explain your thesis? I mean, there's possibly hundreds of them in your book, but many of them seem to start with volcano eruption. So why don't we target the one that happened, I think, about 1,500 years ago in the 6th century? I think there were several volcanoes over the course of about 20 years. Could you explain what happened and also the surprising ripple-on effect for human history that followed?
Sure, great. Well, you know, what I was going to say, when you were saying that we have been out of touch with the environment, the natural world, I don't think that's what people were thinking 1, 2, 3, 4,000 years ago. Some of the very, very earliest texts in history are all about anxieties about environmental change. I mean, you could read the first book of Genesis, you know, the Bible, which is sacred to Jews, to Christians, and also the creation stories of the Quran, which are the same from the book of Genesis, and then the creation stories of here in First Nation peoples and Aboriginal peoples, are all to do with perfect environmental balances. And that if you transgress or disobey your elders or disobey God's command, the punishment is an environmental one. So we've known about this for long, long, long times. The question, I guess, is why have we forgotten about that in the last 200 years? So I'll leave that maybe for later. But volcanoes are a huge part. You know, our ecosystems on this planet are connected to lots of different factors to do with, for example, El Niño, La Niña climate signal, which is the most important climate signal on Earth. But then there are lots of other interlocking smaller patterns that modify and move and change to do with the behavior of the Earth, the rotation around the sun, the sun's behavior, the moon's behavior, etc. And then natural phenomena like volcanoes. So volcanoes, when they erupt, they eject large amounts of particulates up into the atmosphere. A lot depends on how powerful the explosion is, how long it lasts. We've learned a lot about volcanology in the last two or three generations. A lot depends on the latitude of the volcano, so not all volcanoes are equal. And a lot depends on what time of year the volcano erupts. All these things that are kind of obvious once you say them, but, you know, they're incredibly exciting. And when you eject a lot of particles into the atmosphere, it does two things. First, it blocks the sun's rays, and that affects your photosynthesis. If you remember that from school, you need sunlight and water for plants to reproduce. And there are whole ecosystems that follow from that. If there are plants don't produce or they grow weakly, then animal systems cascade downwards. But also those particulates can reflect, they can absorb moisture in the atmosphere and reflect the sun's rays back into outer space. So when you have a sequence of volcanic eruptions, as happens in the 530s and early 540s, probably three, maybe four really quite big eruptions in quite close proximity, there's a whole series of changes that produces, that get written about at the time, that the sun is still in the sky, but you can't feel any warmth coming from it, that crops start to fail and that farmers are complaining they can't feed anybody. There's famine that starts to break out. And probably what happens as a result is that animals are forced out of their natural habitats in search of food as well. That's probably the likely thing that happens. And there are a whole bunch of different foci on Earth, sort of environmental little pockets that harbour plague. And in this particular occasion of 530s and 540s, probably what happens is that animals that live in plague foci are forced into closer proximity with human beings. And as we learned with COVID, when you have trade networks that allow people to move around and to buy and sell goods, that's good in the good times. You can get luxury objects, you can get people, you can get ideas being spread backwards and forwards. The downside is those vectors also spread disease. And what becomes known as the Justinianic plague first is detected in the early 540s at the mouth of the Mediterranean and sweeps through into the Eastern Roman Empire and through the Middle East, probably killing something like 40% of the world, of the population, and possibly more than that. Some of my colleagues argue and think it has a much lower impact. But anyway, that's the kind of the way it's written about. It's kind of biblical pestilence. We're starting to find new signs of it, probably in sub-Saharan West Africa, deep into China too. And the amazing thing about the genetics now is that that's the kind of story that we've heard. It's all been written about for a long time. We can now measure those spreads. But we found recently in rural Cambridgeshire, which is a long way from anywhere, I promise you, not just from Sydney or London, a long way from anywhere, we found the pathogen existing that we can date to before 540, probably 10 years earlier. So plague is existing and being spread by all sorts of smaller cases, but you need a particular set of factors that allow diseases to magnify and catch fire. And the pandemic did lots of things. It killed on a much, much higher level than the coronavirus did. And in the short term, that greatly reduced the ways in which governments could raise money, because most societies were agrarian, so they depend on growing crops and taxing farmers. It means that the poor have greater negotiating power, so inequality in the short term falls because people can negotiate better value for some of their labor. It changes gender balances. People are terrified about dying, so people tend to think, well, I don't want me saving. So when we have a similar thing in the 1340s, again, probably connected to volcanic activity, and that one's only the Black Death, same story. We've got much better evidence that time around, but you kind of have wedding bonanzas. You have people experimenting with fashions. You have people thinking, we're not going to live into ripe old age, so let's party while we enjoy it. And that's all to do with volcanism and with the ways in which complex ecosystems interact with each other. And again, the poor, I'm no friend of the rat. I hate the rat as an animal. But the rat took a lot of blame for spreading of diseases. If you remember your classes you had in history about the spread of the Black Death and these diseases, we now know again that diseases can be spread by birds eating dead animals and then defecating or dying in long way away from where those animals were found. We know that when Yersinia pestis, the pathogen that underpins plague, finds its way to the soil, it can contaminate soil and plants for many years. And we know in rat colonies that once it becomes established, it can survive for 100 years plus. So all these things we've learnt a lot about. But, I guess the bottom line story is that you should probably be prepared for the fact that pathogens arrive and spread quite quickly, and they happen quite regularly. In a world we live in today, those zoonotic jumps, those jumps of diseases from animals into the human ecosystems are regular, and they're rising because a lot of these diseases are highly sensitive to climatic changes.
You make the point in the book that just prior to this sort of 6th century plague and collapse and so on, there were a lot of stable but complex or sophisticated societies that existed in the world. and that it was this complexity that exposed them to sort of a fragility, right? So it was the very complexity that saw them rise and develop various cities and types of bureaucracies that then saw them not survive. Can you explain how that works? Because my understanding is that throughout history, it has in fact been the more complex, more sophisticated societies that have really suffered.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to get too technical. A lot depends on what complex and sophisticated means. Complex and sophisticated tends to mean good news if you're really rich, right? Complex and sophisticated means you've got a lot of people who can do the heavy lifting and produce nice things that allow you to build churches, temples, big palaces. And archaeologists and historians, we love that sort of stuff. Tourists love big buildings. They look good on Instagram. But if you're part of the peasant workforce, which is the vast majority of the population, then giving up your labor to allow other people to have good times with frescoes on their walls and, you know, dancing girls and beautiful silver platters to serve their feasts on, you know, one has to think about who gets the benefits of those sophistications. But insofar as big states with have big administrations and bureaucracies that make them function well, you know, I suppose the natural example is if you're on an airplane and, you know, a single screw fails, you're all dead. You know, something that's big is easy to bring down. And things that are small and gritty tend to work out okay. So, you know, that's something which I think is quite important with empires. They tend not to go up in smoke in big explosions like the Death Star at the end of Star Wars. Or Star Wars keeps on giving birth to new Star Wars. The original first Star Wars where the Death Star blows up. That tends not to be how the Roman Empire or the Mongols or the British Empire. It always tends to be quite a sort of low decompression, like a slow puncture. But it's an important thing to kind of realize that when you're hyper-connected, then you're hyper-fragile and hyper-vulnerable. And again, if we'd been talking before coronavirus and the pandemic, it would have been harder to explain that. But we now know that one bat incident in Wuhan, however that happened, and I'm not here to argue or complain to anybody who has a different view, that a single connector point or connector means that because we're linked by, you know, all by global flight patterns that are hugely intensive, that more or less every single part of the world is 24 hours connected to each other. In some cases, normally less. You know, if you're between Sydney and London, it's a long way. But if you're anywhere in between, you know, you can be half that distance. So, you know, so I think that those ideas that small chinks can create big effects, we know from quantum physics. We know if you chuck a stone into a window, a small little stone into a big window, that frosting of how it splinters, small things can bring down big states and big empires. And it doesn't take much to collapse those networks.
And is that what happened in the 6th century after these sort of volcanoes?
Well, you know, lots of things happen. I mean, I suppose in the short run, what happens is that states have greatly reduced ability to collect money because there's less being produced. And so there's an immediate correction to standards of living and to expectations of what the future might look like. So that means you cut back on your defense spending. It means you cut down on the size of your army. It means you cut down on civic buildings of the things that make you look great and famous. And of course, that can create opportunities for your rivals who have been sort of kept to one side because the power of your state looks surprisingly large, means that you can create opportunities. And those opportunities are quite good to exploit from the periphery. So it normally is from the edges that things start to sort of get compressed. I mean, it slightly depends where you look. I mean, one of the things that happens in Scandinavia as a result both of disease but also collapsed trade networks is that you start to find land being available for cheaper and cheaper prices. So you have a rise of super landlord, and those super landlords, we know them today as the Vikings, right? So you find these guys who have large amounts of land, great power, great authority, and what they start to do is when they start to colonize places like Iceland, there are too many chiefs. And the way that they solve that problem in Iceland is by creating a parliament where all the voices are, well, notionally equal. I mean, equal meaning if you're a rich man, rather than that excludes already more than half the population of women, and then another probably half by... But so you have lots of different knock-on effects that change all sorts of different things. In the Justinianic plague in the 6th century, you find a lot of apocalyptic writing of people saying this is what happens when you disobey and you live in immoral ways. Lots of people being terrified about changes to the environment. And it's no surprise that, you know, the holy book of the Quran that is the recitations given to Muhammad in the early 600s talks about the precariousness of nature and about how in paradise there would be perfect, you know, rivers and honey and sweetness and plenty of water. And those kinds of things are perhaps not surprising coming from the Hejaz, which is a notoriously dry, the Arabian Peninsula, there's not a single lake, not a single river. So lots of things are all knitted into each other. But one of the things that happens is collapse of long-distance trade, collapse of elites, collapse of big buildings. And, you know, one question is that that's bad for the elites and for rulers. That may not be bad for women. That may not be bad for the poor. That may not be bad for children. It's bad for literacy. It's bad for lots of things that we prize today. But it's trying to work out what you think is the most important.
And while we're on volcanoes, another example in history that I find really interesting is the eruption of Okmok in Alaska, I think in 43 BC, may have played a role in the demise of Cleopatra. Are you able to just give a bit of a rundown on how that works?
Sure. I mean, one of the challenges with environmental history, like all history, is not to kind of overcook your goose or overbake your cookies, whatever cooking expression you want to use. What happens in 44 BC, the Ides of March, Julius Caesar is stabbed to death because there's an idea that he's either too powerful or he's too unpopular or maybe wants to become the ruler. I mean, he is essentially the undisputed ruler anyway. And what happens as the squads go out to look for Brutus and Cassius in particular to bring them to heel, there's an eruption in Alaska that is of reasonably high magnitude. It's a high latitude, Alaska in the north, and it comes at a quite a high time of year. We can see the signature in the northern hemisphere in ice cores in Greenland and so on. And what seems to happen is that has an impact on the Nile flood. The Nile every year has a very predictable flood. It always comes. Sometimes it's bigger, sometimes it's lesser. And it spreads large amounts of nutrients over the ground that make Egypt the single most important producer of crops in the whole Mediterranean. And at that time, you'll remember from either your asterisks or from your history lessons that Egypt is run by a woman called Cleopatra, incredibly talented, multilingual, highly sophisticated. Her biggest weakness is not that she's a woman. Her biggest weakness is that she's the descendant of Greek generals. So she's a member of the Ptolemy dynasty. And the way that Ptolemies have kept power is that brothers marry sisters, or that's what they say. But, you know, I think they're all able to get busy in different ways. But it makes her highly vulnerable to domestic Egyptian aristocrats who always have a reckoning that maybe they should be running the country and having the benefits of full power. As the Nile floods fail, the crops are in short supply. What always happens as a result in every single environment is that there's inflation, partly because there's less availability, so prices go up, but also if you have got crops, you hoard them because the prices go up. And Cleopatra faces Egypt with a cost of living crisis, with catastrophic food problems, disease kicks in. And at that particular moment, she reckons that the smartest move will be to ally herself with the hero of the Roman army to protect Egypt in this time of peril. And she throws a lot in with Mark Antony, who has famously nice calves. He waxes his legs a lot. He's seen a lot of military action. He's a good bet to pick on. But it turns out that he's a man past his sell-by date. And Octavian comes to try, who had been working with Mark Antony, comes to track Mark Antony down and with Cleopatra in the city of Alexandria in 30 BC. Octavian makes himself the master of Egypt. Cleopatra dies probably through self-administered poison, whether it's a stake or not, we don't know. And then Octavian comes back to Rome, and the grateful Senate say to him he should now be known by the name of Augustus, which means blessed or chosen one. I suppose in today's vernacular, it means you lucky bastard, because he brought so much wealth into Rome as a result of essentially free food that Rome at that point shifted from being a republic into literally an empire, both territorially, economically. And when Augustus dies 20 years later or so, no, 50 years later, so in about 18 AD, he leaves on his memoirs a big wall you can still see in Rome today saying, I found the city in brick and I left it in marble. And that injection of cash, all to do, you know, it's not because there was a volcanic eruption, the volcano, those headwinds might have happened anyway. But there's environmental factors are always part of something that goes on this great stage of history. And because we spend all of our time, like I said, looking at individuals, we forget about the natural environment. We forget about crops and yields and shocks. And economic and shocks can produce social and political shocks too. And you know, another good example of that with the volcano in Lombok in 1815. Produces a change of allowing more men to be allowed to vote in Europe. It's the same kinds of processes. If you cut food, you create protest movements, and you can result in very dramatic political change too.
So did a volcano lead to the fall of Rome? Because I know there's a lot of bros on TikTok and around the place, because it's become a meme, who love to talk about the Roman Empire. It's become an obsession. How did that collapse? Because I know it collapsed over a period of time and there are countless theories on it. What's your take?
Well, the thing that most historians will say drove the collapse of Rome was that it was a series of migrations from across Eurasia. So people preceding the Mongols, called the Goths and then the Avars, being forced across the spine of Asia in search of greater or better land for themselves, for their horses and water availability. And the arrival of
drought. There was a big drought that happened. Is that
multi-decade aridity, and it doesn't mean that people suddenly have to gallop hundreds of miles in different directions. It's that they start to fight about things, and when you start to fight, you can establish your tribe to become bigger because you bring over the people you've conquered into your federation. And as you become bigger, your muscles grow and your opportunities likewise. So eventually the Goths and then the Avars, who are the really important ones, and then the Huns first, then the Avars reach the borders of the Danube. And it doesn't take much to push the Roman Empire over the edge. And what happens, although the way it used to be written about was that it's just mass violence, actually what the Goths and the Huns and the Avars really want is to be paid off with hush money. You know, that's the cheapest way to make money, is to threaten people. That's how, you know, any kind of mafia type group organizes. You say, look, you do the work, you run your restaurant, I'm going to turn up once every month, this is what you're going to pay me. Much better than doing the work yourself. And the arguments about how much they should be paid, who should pay them, how that money should be raised, and so on, lead to the collapse of trade networks because of uncertainty. And Western Europe slides off the cliff into what used to be known as the Dark Ages. And today we sort of try to think, well, it's maybe a bit more atomized, a bit more interesting than that. But basically people stop reading in the Western Europe. People stop building in stone. You know, people start to live and die within 5-6 miles of where they're born rather than being spread over longer distances. And that's not to do with volcanism. It's not to do with hyperdrought. It's to do with the whole series of factors that ultimately lead to the fact that Rome's not able to adapt at speed to the fact that you've got lots of guys knocking on the door asking for money. And if you can't pay, then those guys knocking on the door do what all groups do. They turn violent. And if you turn violent, you know, you can sack a city once and take away its gold and its silver and its women and, you know, all the horrors that happen in cases like that. But you can't, you know, it's diminishing returns. If you come back a few years later, there's not so much there second time around. So all of these things fold into the fact that Western Europe subsides and collapses. And a different equation is made in the eastern part of the Roman Empire that is still the Roman Empire. It's just later historians in the West call it the Byzantine Empire because it makes them sound less fancy and less able to claim the legacy of Rome.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A big part of the thesis of your book is that so much of history is not just about the climate calamities that happened, but our ability to adapt. I mean, really, that's what has shaped our trajectory. And I'm wondering if you could maybe share some favourite examples of how that played out. And perhaps you might even want to, we've touched on it already, but the sort of the way that religion took a different form in different parts of the world. There was obviously moralising types of religions in a lot of the world, but in some parts, like in China, they didn't work to these moralizing gods. It was very different. And you explain it via climate events.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess it's the wonderful thing about history is that, and like a jigsaw puzzle, is that when complicated pieces fit together, there's a real sense of satisfaction of kind of, my God, that all makes sense to me. And a lot of our religions in Europe and in the Middle East and so on have quite important climatic contexts to them, and our mythologies too, you know, the punishments of droughts and of floods from Noah, etc. onwards. You know, it's a hugely important part of our cultural background. You know, I guess even things like Joseph and his Technicolor Dreamcoat, you know, it's Joseph warning Pharaoh that in the 7 years of plenty, you need to make sure you put stuff aside, because not thanks to your incompetence, but if you have droughts or famine, that you've got stuff that's being protected. So people were really conscious about that. But for all sorts of different reasons, the cosmologies in places like East Asia are very, very different, particularly in China. And that ranges not just from what people believe, but also in terms of how people bury their dead. So in tropical climates, bodies decompose very quickly and spread disease too. In northern parts of China, where you have great city civilizations too, you find bodies that are laid out to rest for a long period of time because the same process of decomposition takes a lot longer. So the ways in which you venerate the dead are different. So that's one thing. But also in Chinese cultures, you know, you remember things like Confucius and the idea of Tao and Dao, that you should, you know, just be mindful and you should be thoughtful about other people. That there's no ways in which people get punished in the same way that you can do in other parts of the world. And it's a little bit of a generalization. So in the book, for those who are interested, please read it and you know, go. It takes, you know, very careful to try and explain that generalizations can be the enemy of good history by being careful about what you write about, when and how and by who. But it seems to be that the ideas about vengeful gods, vengeful deities, seem to be more apparent and correlated to places where you have big hurricanes, big storms, unpredictable weather patterns. And, you know, when we all of us look up into the sky every day, if it's the rains pouring down or the sun beating down on us, it's not surprising that we conceptualize heaven as being above us, up in the skies. But different belief systems emerge in different parts of the world. And that idea about moralizing gods, I think, is a really interesting one to be thinking about. How come we are all still connected to the same kinds of questions? You know, why should we be good to each other? Should we support people who are poor if you're rich? And if so, why? Why do good things happen to bad people? And why do bad things happen to good people? And to try to look for those kinds of explanations, all of our common ancestors have been deeply engaged trying to solve those difficult, thorny, existential, and really interesting questions about how to live a good life and what comes after we die. And, you know, now, today we live in a kind of post-religion world where everyone thumbs their nose at thinking about, well, this is all hokum pokum. We now live in a world of individualism where there are risks when everybody is their own god and has their own set of beliefs. Turns out that there are those ties that connect us all together can be quite valuable as well by giving us common identities. And, you know, that's something I think we should be thinking about in the 21st century as we go forward. The fact that our communities operate at individual basis rather than at household or neighborhood levels. You know, there are downsides of choosing to solve problems in your own way, come up with your own answers that may turn out to be not smarter than the ones of people who've gone before us.
I think that's a really good point. Yeah. A big elephant in the room, I suppose, in all of this, when we're talking about the role of climate in history and the human experience, is that the climate situation that we are now in, we very much created it. And that's quite different to you know, what happened in the past. And on top of that, our society is more interconnected, more complex than ever before. Everything is global. So even climate issues, you know, are global. In the past, a volcano eruption might affect a small part of the world and then you'd see collapses and implications going on there. But we now have an atmosphere that is global. I think most of the heating that occurs is happening globally, but also trade, finance, the whole internet, it's a whole stack of dominoes ready to kind of be tipped. What are the implications of this interconnectivity and the fact that, you know, the climate change is human caused for the first time in history?
Well, I guess the bottom line is we're not all in it together. You know, so these global changes affect those who are least able to cope with them by far worse than rich developed societies and economies, and aggravates existing injustices often connected to previous eras of history and empire, ages of empire. So, you know, for example, the continent of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, as far as 10 years ago, consumed as a total landmass the same amount of electricity as New York City. You know, today, Africa as a continent as a whole receives only 3% of all climate finance. You know, for a world that is hugely capable for installing solar and renewables, you know, a reasonably low cost, and the price of solar has fallen 99% in the last 35 years. So unfortunately, we don't all have to adapt at the same speed, because if you've got money, you can pay your way out of trouble. So I think that the first thing is that we're in a really sticky, bad place environmentally. It's not just about warming and climate. It's about things like air quality and air pollution. It's about which cascade into neonatal birth, which we've seen reports just here in Australia. A report came out last week by University of Western Australia about heat being connected to early birth, so preterm, so before 37 weeks. And that has measurable and very significant impacts on life expectancies, on cognitive abilities, on outcomes. And that means that it's not all fair. So in the grand scheme, that those kinds of inequalities are going to will accelerate and deepen unless we can find global action that tries to find ways of helping those most in need. And, you know, here in the Australia's backyard, trying to engage with Pacific Islanders and the front line of where climate change and sea level rises come, you know, question ultimately boils down to respect, integrity, but also who's willing to pay the price. But, you know, I think we're in a world where we're disengaging from each other, are finding it much, much harder to think that we should upgrade each other's own neighbourhood and keep our resources for ourselves. But, you know, having said that, there are lots of good things that we do as global citizens. But, you know, we should do a lot more of that, a lot more intensively. But, you know, I think that the coming decades, where we look at water failure, water shortages, potential water wars, collapse of glaciers, collapse of ice in the Antarctic, sea level rises, you know, no one is safe from this sort of stuff. And it won't happen dramatically, like in a movie, although that can sometimes happen with a series of factors, particularly involving disease. But, you know, it's how do you adapt? And is it better to spend money now or to spend more money later? And, you know, anyone who runs a household budget, when you're faced with a bill that you don't want that's gone red, you know, it's not going to go away. So it's better to take the pain and try to then regroup rather than kick the can down the road.
Just back to adaptation, as I say, the book covers a lot of ways that humans have adapted to different climate disasters, and it's actually then led to incredible innovations and changes in the way that society operates that we now, you know, consider to be quite significant in human history. Are there any lessons from history that I think, you know, maybe those of us listening, those of us that are aware that we're currently in a sixth extinction and would probably like to maybe learn from past lessons, are there any sort of, I guess, hacks or moments that we might want to take? I mean, having read a fair bit about the collapse of different societies throughout history, I think Jared Diamond in his book Collapse, and then Peter Tainter as well, they touch on this idea that societies that continued business as usual, so these complex societies that failed to adjust to the climate calamity that hit them, they're the ones that failed. Those that were able to adjust went on to thrive and you know, they created history. Can you maybe give some examples that we might want to take notice of at this juncture in history?
Any state, empire, whatever, that survives for a long period of time is doing its job well. And, you know, so for example, the Byzantine Empire, which is a particular favourite of mine, manages for 1,000 years across multi-climatic, multi-pandemic, multi-religious, multilingual zones to be able to create stability. And it creates administrative bureaucratic stability that allows for, broadly speaking, a meritocracy to encourage the right people to get the right positions of power, a highly sophisticated justice system that is not, you can't buy the support of the judge, and it works. We tend not to study places that work. The Ottoman Empire, another one, lasts for 700 years. The Mongols have a terrible press and PR. But things that are resilient, and from my point of view, I'm always interested in things that are inclusive, that have reasonable rights that are given, not just to rich men, but places that are more sophisticated in terms of their hereditability, in terms of who gets to inherit everything. And lots of societies in the Middle East, lots of societies in Eastern Europe have been quite good at recycling to not just make the chinless wonder son have everything and massive house that he builds for himself. So the ways in which assets get recycled It's very sophisticated in places like Venice, in the Ottoman world, in the Byzantine world, and in the Safavid Empire and so on. That happens a lot, but those guys get missed out in history because we're more interested in kind of Napoleon reaching Moscow and then the snow or setting fire to Moscow, being beaten back and, you know, hundreds of thousands of his men dying of frostbite, of cold on the way back. So I think that there are lots of specific examples of things that work. From Mesoamerican societies to hugely sophisticated, stable states that are able to cope with big extremes and swings. A lot of it is about making sure that you have resources for a rainy day. A lot is to do with things like irrigation systems that aren't oversweated. A lot is to do with just understanding basic soil chemistry, that if you get soil chemistry wrong, your nutrients collapse and you can't grow stuff. So being sustainable doesn't just mean that you like the ecosystems. It's very good long-term planning. And long-term planning is not that hard to do. It just requires a little bit of vision. And it does require education to understand everything from soil science to inequality, to understanding what it is that brings revolts and what brings collapse. But, you know, I can tell you for hours that collapse comes when you, like Benjamin Franklin famously said it, if you fail to prepare, you prepare to fail. And, you know, we live in a world today that's hyperconnected, just-in-time supply chains. We should have learned a lot of lessons from COVID and the pandemic. And it's not clear to me at all that we have thought too hard about what those kind of fracture points might look like in the world of, you know, not tomorrow, the world of today as well.
And I've heard theories that say that declines in democracy can be one of the biggest determiners of whether a society can adjust and adapt or not. And obviously, I think 90% of democracies or OECD countries are currently experiencing a decline in democracy. So there's a number of factors that are at play here. You mentioned stability, you mentioned equity. They're all factors that can determine whether a society can withstand a climate calamity. You mentioned at the top of this chat about the way that various religious leaders and historians have referred to our relationship with climate. And in fact, at the beginning of your book, you run a bunch of quotes from different people and in different parts of religious texts. In the past, we had this reverence for nature and this idea that if we did not keep the holy balance of nature, there would be repercussions, right? And we knew that, we lived that. So much of our existence evolved in and around that knowledge. And as we get close to recent times, that's all but being obliterated. You know, there's climate denial as an extreme version of this, but also there's just this extractive overlord mentality where we are not of a habitat. You know, we are different to the animal world, and that comes through in all different kinds of quotes that you run at the front of the book. What is the peril of that? What is the danger of that, given where we are in history, arguably in a sixth extinction caused by our own insistence on being separate from nature?
It's a great question. I wish I had a good answer, but I imagine your answer would be better than mine. What do you think?
Well, I think it comes back to the spiritual implications. You know, I'm speaking to a whole range of different climate experts, collapse experts, billionaires who are trying to fathom all of this. And often it comes down to, gosh, there's some spiritual element to this that we're missing. And by spiritual, I mean just kind of a connectedness. But yeah, I think the ramifications are such that we aren't able to solve the complex problems that we've created because we're applying the same mindset that caused it in the first place, which is, you know, as Einstein says, is the definition of insanity. And so we're going around in circles and we are adding to the very problem with the extra complexity that we're creating. So renewables and this idea that we're all going to be saved by the renewable transition is again another extractive mindset because we're not thinking about the fact that, you know, solar and wind are not renewable. You know, you've got the cobalt issues that are happening in the Congo and so on. And latest reports are saying we're not going to make it. It's actually, there are not enough fossil fuels to actually power the transition, to create the materials and the setup and infrastructure to get us to that point. So yeah, I feel that the whole mindset is contributing and making things worse.
I mean, look, as a historian, I can offer you two things that you could buy one or the other, but you probably can't buy both. One is the negative and the horrors and the disasters and, you know, the things that look to me pretty well baked in of the challenges coming towards us, because a lot of the damage is already done. No matter how much we transition into renewables and so on, it's about decisions that were made over the last 30, 40, 50 years that the consequences take time to play through. You know, nature doesn't respond like blue ticks on WhatsApp. You know, it takes a while. So that, you know, so I'm not unsympathetic to the catastrophes. I suppose the positive side is that, I'd be slightly glib, you know, what keeps me awake at night at the moment is nuclear proliferation and new diseases, either synthetic or natural diseases that spread as a result of the ways in which we're connected. So it might be other things get us before global warming does anyway. So we've got to be mindful of that. And those horrors and dangers are there too. I guess the positive side is, you know, look, if you want to look on the metrics, our demographics look like they're going to be fewer of us by the end of this century in most parts of the world. That's not uniform and so on. But, you know, partly to do with the fact that women are better educated, they have much more control over their bodies and over their reproductions, and therefore they're going to, you know, we're having populations that are falling. And that might mean that, you know, a blessing, not because we're chosen to correct the climate, but there'll be fewer mouths to feed, and, you know, that process could be managed in a way that is quite beneficial. We need to extract less because, you know, we become more efficient. So that there are ways in which one can be positive about this as well.
Except that very phenomenon is going to lead to an economic collapse, which is another really major threat, which will probably come before climate collapse.
Yeah, you know, that's probably not great if you're a billionaire whose business model is reliant on selling more and more and more of something. But, you know, I will take that as a SAG of how do you make the pie, how do you carve it up in different ways. And if there are fewer of us, then it's true, your capacity to keep on becoming wealthier or expanding your business, you know, that may be something that gets a correction too. I'm you know, my Byzantine friends weren't too bothered about that. I mean, they had basically zero inflation for the best part of 700 years. You know, the price of bread, price of a fish cost the same thing, and they were perfectly happy. They wrote wonderful poetry, great music, great buildings. People can do lots of wonderful things without thinking that their share portfolio is going to go up in value. You know, so those corrections about house pricing, about real estate, about opportunities for young people, those things might change. And they might change in ways that are dangerous and make things worse, but they could do things that are positive too. You know, I do stand in a long line of people who've written about history and about the environment. And a lot of those people who I follow have predicted global disaster, you know, of not being able to feed people, catastrophic population loss. And this is not just Malthus and people writing 200 years ago. You know, even the CIA and others 10, 20, 30 years ago saying we're on the edge of disaster. You know, if you, for any, again, any newborn, who's coming into the world when we are talking today, you know, one would always want to try and pick a message of hope and happiness over disaster and chaos, partly because self-fulfilling prophecies of the fact we're going to hell in a handcart can produce decisions that make things even worse. So, you know, one of the quotes I put at the front page of my book, you mentioned some of the religious texts. The bottom one is one by Donald Trump, which says on the climate change report, said, "I've read it and I don't believe it." And, you know, if you think that things are going to be bad and you've got nothing to lose, then maybe you make even worse decisions than thinking, look, we're in a tight spot. How do we make the least bad decisions, and how do we start to work together? And you know, I don't think that's my job as a historian to tell people what they should do, but I know how I'd try and solve that equation myself.
Okay. That's probably a good note to end on. I will have to ask one last little question, a side note question. How on earth, Peter, do you hold all of this information, the dates, the sequencing, the theories, the theses that you're working to, how do you hold them in your mind's eye as you write a book, which I think is 600 pages long? Do you have post-it notes all over your sort of your study? How does that operate? And how long did it take you to write this book? This is sort of a sort of a nerdy, granular writer's question.
It's a lovely question, and that's a real compliment. You know, I it's my job, I guess, that helps. You know, that I'm supposed to be, they don't just make any idiot professor. Well, I don't know, maybe they do. I was going to say, they don't make any idiot.
I think they have.
you know, it's my job. I'm passionate about it. I love it. It's not a chore. I mean, I have a real privilege to do the work that I do. And I care and I'm interested in all this stuff. And if you're interested in things, it's very easy to remember them. I think it's when you're trying to remember things that you don't really care about that there's a problem. But it does feel like putting a million piece jigsaw together, and it's not easy to do. And, you know, I'm sure there are things I should have done differently and better and could have done differently and better. But one of a great hero of mine was a French historian called Fernand Braudel. He said the only job of a historian is to be ambitious. So trying to take on big topics six big questions and to try and make them have sense that they can be read by as wide a readership as possible without disappearing into nuance all the time and hiding behind footnotes. But it's taken a long time to write. But a lot of these ideas, a lot of the things that I've read...
What's a long time? What's a long time specifically?
Well, so I some of the stuff on Soviet ideas and Russian ideas about the ecology I read about when I was a 18, 19-year-old boy. And so that's been sitting in the attic in my back of my brain for 30 years plus. I mean, I gave the first lecture about history and climate change at the Getty Center in LA in something like 2016. Or 2017, and I'd already been thinking around a lot of these themes beforehand, but that was the kind of starting, I guess that's the kind of starter's pistol to go, you've got a few ideas, you test drive them, you talk to people who work in that area and space, you think whether they sort of think you've got something interesting to say, and then it's finding time, and as most of us were locked down in COVID, I had a year and a half where I was able to make a lot of progress on a book that otherwise would have taken years and years, and our librarians were heroic at that time. And again, 20 years ago, before digital technologies, before I could look at scholarly articles, you can download them in real time onto your laptop. This it would have taken me 30 years to do. So I have the real benefit of new technologies that have allowed me to be a more wide-ranging historian than I could have been when I was, or could have dreamt of as when I was a boy.
And I think we've got a benefit being of our generation because we remember a time when we had to go to a library and use the Dewey system and go up and actually read the entire book to find the one paragraph that we needed. So we've got that skill set and then the appreciation of technology that enables us to take us, to those places faster. I get it. Thank you so much for this conversation. It was wonderful. You've left me and I'm sure many others with a lot to think about. I recommend reading your book. I think there are many lessons, a lot to do with volcanoes, to be taken from it. And good luck with your journey. Good luck with whatever it is that you're working on next. Thanks again, Peter.
Thanks, Sarah. Thank you for giving me so much time to talk. And good luck with all of your work. This stuff is so important and it needs people to connect with audiences like yours. So it's a privilege to come and talk to you today. Thank you.
It's super interesting to absorb Peter's takes, his findings, in the context of other theories on the trajectory of past civilizational collapses, which we've touched on here on Wild a few times before. Jared Diamond, who wrote the best-selling book Collapse in the early 2000s, argues that it's always climate that triggers a civilizational collapse. It's the climate that can push the set of dominoes over. And what determines whether a society makes it through is whether the elites, the leaders in charge, continue as business as usual or whether they in fact adapt. Others such as Peter Tainter, they say that complexity is the point here, that the more layers, the more pieces, the more interconnectedness, the more sophistication, the more people, the more layers of bureaucracy determine whether a society will collapse. So the bigger the plane, the more likely that one screw loose will bring it undone. In part because the more complex something is, the more involved the solutions will be, which then adds to the complexity that then helps topple the whole heaving thing over. All of which does not augur well for our very, very complex society and for the fact that our elites, our leaders, are more wedded to business as usual, or BAW, than ever before, which as per the final to and fro that Peter and I had at the end of our conversation, is kind of key. We as a culture, as a society, as a civilization, as a global humanity, steadfastly refuse to let go of this constructed lie that we are separate from nature. We mention a series of quotes that appear at the front of Peter's book that illustrate how the relationship that we as humans have had to climate and nature has shifted over the years. The last quote, as Peter references, is from Trump, which basically denies climate change. But the first is from a Judaist text from the 6th century. It goes, "When God created the first human, he took him and led him around all the trees of the Garden of Eden and said to him, 'Pay attention that you do not corrupt and destroy my world. If you corrupt it, there is no one to repair it after you.'" Like I say to Peter, a big part of the issue that we face is our insistence, and it's a fairly modern idea, that we are separate to nature. We almost pride ourselves on being too adaptable and too inventive to be pinned down to something like habitat and to weather patterns and so on.
I think humans have probably always felt this way, and it has in fact seen us adapt and invent and do great things. But this kind of false tendency has always been kept in check by moralist gods, for instance, or by lessons that had to be learned the hard way, often by a climate wipeout event. My persistent question that I put to Peter that he sort of answers is, can we learn from the lessons of the past? Well, yes and no is his answer. We rarely get the lesson. Throughout history, we've rarely got the lesson. We're often thwacked over the head and often a little too late. Peter veers into the space many of us do when pressed on this topic, the perilousness of our future, and says that, you know, we shouldn't be doomers. We should tell stories of hope and so on. But I'd argue, and many of you would know this, it has been the opposite that has produced the best results in our history. It was the moralizing by gods. It was the dark warnings about getting too greedy. It was, I guess, the comforting framing words that alerted humans to the tough times ahead and to the need to maintain stability and, very importantly, equality, which are two factors that, you know, economists like Gaia Harrington from the Club of Rome, who was on Wild some time back, say are key to minimizing harm from climate collapse. I'll put the link to that episode in the show notes. Anyway, I'll leave you with all of those thoughts and stay wild, keep your conversations wild and roaming and open, and I'll see you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.